Thank you. I know I'm back home in Kentucky when I see people stand for the pledge, bow their head for the prayer, and even sometimes applaud the prayer, which I like as well. But it is good to be home. I heard this was going to be faith and freedom, and I had to do a little more than just a political speech, I thought. And then they told me there were going to be pastors here, and I was like, I better bring notes. Just in case. I don't get in any trouble with all the pastors here. But I've given a speech similar to this before at religious universities, at commencements, and in the discussion of faith and freedom nationally. Some people worry that liberty and virtue are incompatible. I would argue that they actually complement each other, and that liberty and virtue are really necessarily intertwined. I think virtue means really absolutely nothing, though, unless it's voluntarily chosen. If you don't choose to be virtuous, you know, we're just not all of a sudden virtuous. You have to choose to be a good person. You have to choose to understand right and wrong. I think liberty requires virtue. Otherwise, liberty becomes libertine. Do whatever you want. Be whatever you want. Don't care about others. But liberty requires virtue. And I think our republic requires that. Our founding fathers often said that a democratic nation requires a virtuous people. That was George Washington. But to a person, each of our original founding members believed that our country, a free country, that freedom required and had to be girded and bounded by virtue. The author Oz Guinness writes that liberty requires restraint, but the only restraint consistent with liberty is voluntary or self-restraint. And there's a lot in that statement that, you know, nobody else can make these rules. Well, these are rules you make on yourself. These are rules that you accept for yourself, but they're important and they can't be discounted. And that we get to a nation that has no rules and has no self-restraint, we have a problem. And I think that's what we're facing. Many historians write that the American Revolution was different than the French Revolution. How was it different? How did we get so lucky? How did we not wind up in the chaos of the French Revolution? Well, the French Revolution tossed a king. The American Revolution tossed a king. But we didn't also toss, because our religion had already become somewhat separated from the king, and there had been hundreds of years of trying to separate religion, not all of it, but at least separate a lot of our religious faith and different denominations from the king, there was still faith without the king. In France, there was one religion. It was the government religion. It was associated with the king. When the king was gone, they basically went to, instead of just liberty, they went to libertine. They went to no rules, and it ended in chaos. One of the things that I think people don't talk enough about in our country, and it isn't taught enough to our kids, is that we really had a lot of traditions that carried on, not only our religious traditions, but think about it. The House of Burgess, which is the parliament or the Congress of Virginia, I think began meeting around 1640. So by the time you get to our Revolutionary War, they've been meeting 120 years. Most of the 13 colonies all had state governments that were relatively uninterrupted. So we didn't have war where there was ultimate chaos. We had war and we still had 13 governing bodies that had 100-year history. But even more than that, think about the tradition. We think of the American Revolution as being this one-off, and ours was great, and you know we were so much different than everything else. But really, in England, this battle had been going on really since the Magna Carta. So we go back to, you know, 1215, and what's happening, the barons, the royal people, are trying to get a little bit of power away from the king. Then the parliament tries to get, they'd already had a civil war in England where the parliament tried to take more power. And by the time you get to our Revolutionary War, they had already gone after the king. And then we're going after it. It's why we actually had people in the English parliament that were sympathetic to the American Revolution. But it really has to be seen in the continuous sort of struggle. We have a 1,000-year history of being distrustful of one person having all the power, of central authority. 1,000 years we've been fighting this. So it isn't a one-off. It isn't a brand new thing for us. But we were lucky that we didn't wind up like France. But as we look around the modern world, I think we see signs that virtue is under attack, and that what was once considered to be degenerate is now the norm, and the standards of virtue are crumbling. America's challenge, as the author Oz Guinness puts it, is not wolves at the door, but termites in the floor. Our foundation is cracking, and I can tell you, because I just had mine fixed, it's expensive to fix the foundation. But this is a foundational problem. This isn't just something nibbling at the edges. If we become a country with no virtue, if we become a country that doesn't believe in right and wrong, we are in a very bad way. Think of it this way, and you think, well, can government just fix this problem? Think of it this way. If I were to tomorrow get rid of all rules on stealing, raise your hand if you would go out and start stealing. Now, nobody's going to raise their hand, but nobody would do it. None of us would go steal. We don't steal because there's a law. We don't steal because there's right and wrong. The only way we survive as a country, if nobody believes in Hopkinsville and right and wrong, and everybody believes stealing is okay, you can't have enough police. You could have 10,000 police, but when you have 10,000 police, you'll have no freedom. We have our freedom because we have self-restraint. We are keeping our liberty restricted to doing what is right. When I first ran for office, and even today, people come up to me and said they're praying for me. And I was like, you know, at first I was just unusual. It was unusual for me. I was a physician, but almost nobody came up to me and said they were praying for me. Now everybody says they're praying for me. It's like, you know, and at first I didn't know how to respond. And after a while, I was like, wow, that's really nice that people are praying for me. And after I've been in Washington a while, after I've been physically assaulted once, after I'd been mobbed with my wife by a mob, I was like, please pray for me and for my wife and for my family. Many of the problems we're facing today, though, are not brand new. Even at the time of the Civil War, Lincoln understood our peril and warned that as America, as a nation of free men, that America must live through all time or die by suicide. I think what he meant by this was that the enemy was, even then, not from without, but from within. We have to worry more about the crumbling of our country, the crumbling of our moral foundation from within than we do from without. Doesn't mean we're not prepared to defend the country, but if we don't defend who we are and our foundation, there won't be anything for the army to defend. The dilemma works each decade, and I think it's worsening. And I believe we've arrived at a time of reckoning. Will we falter, or will we thrive and rediscover our greatness? I think America has much greatness in her. As far as success and prosperity, everywhere I go, I see it. Even you say, oh, we're just middle class, we're not that rich. The middle class in this time period, in our lifetime, is richer than they have ever been, beyond imagination. We just don't see it because we're so used to it. But just imagine your parents or your grandparents, lack of food, all of the things and the ability to have leisure that we didn't have. If you go back to 1820, 98% of the country, our country and the world really, lived in extreme poverty, less than $2 a day. They never had enough to eat. They were always scrounging. They had one set of clothes. So, I mean, imagine how it is. You talk about the bad things, bigotry, discrimination, all the hatred between races and religions. There's less of that than ever before. I'm not going to say there's none, but there's less than ever before. There's never been a better time to be alive than now. Economically, prosperity is there. But I worry it doesn't continue unless we keep the moral foundation and understand that virtue is a necessity. Some people think, well, government's the answer. Government can just do it. If we're having trouble, maybe government can make us a moral people again. Can government help us? Can they help us to have a sense of morality? The answer is an emphatic no. Virtue doesn't come from legal edicts. Laws don't create virtue. You can only accept this yourself. You can only find it yourself. But no government's going to give you this. I think a war, though, exists between those who seek to divide us and those who wish to guide us. A war is being waged between those who understand and embrace America's exceptional past and those who simply want to divide us. As Thomas Paine wrote, these are the times that try men's souls. I think today those words are still appropriate. How do we find our way back to the traditions of the fathers? Well, Don Devine is a friend of mine. He worked in the Reagan administration. If he worked that long ago, he's getting up in years, but he's a great guy and an author. He writes of how freedom and tradition are intertwined, sort of like liberty and virtue, but just different words, freedom and tradition. He said freedom needs tradition for law, order, inspiration. You know, freedom with no rules, unbounded freedom, is licentiousness, libertine. There has to be some restraint. So freedom needs law, order, and inspiration. But tradition, the rules that guide us, also need freedom to escape stagnation, coercion, and decline. He says that the great achievement of the Constitution's framers was in providing a means for synthesizing freedom and tradition, not getting one without the other. The French Revolution gave them the freedom, but they didn't keep the tradition. They didn't keep the faith. They didn't keep their religious sense of right and wrong. I think America needs to revive our traditions, our faith, or as Oz Guinness might say, America needs to revive virtue. Or as Billy Graham might say, America needs to revive the hope that springs eternal from the transcendent teachings of a humble carpenter who died on the cross. Government can supply bread, but it can't mend a broken spirit. Mother Teresa, once praised for her social work in India, said, "We are not social workers. We do this for Jesus." No secular government worker can claim that, no matter how good. It really is about what the motivation is. The Journal of Social Studies asked high school students what citizenship meant to them. They responded that it meant helping people, committees, churches. Citizenship and good government, though, require the involvement of a virtuous people. Your faith, your church, our God, belong in the public arena. Don't let anyone tell you otherwise. Some on the left mistakenly argue that the First Amendment is about keeping religious people out of government. No, the First Amendment is about keeping government out of religion. No government, no law can force people to be virtuous. Our churches, schools, and parents must fill that void. Sometimes I'll sit with a group of 10 pastors and they'll be looking at me and I'll be looking right back at them. Because, while I want these things to happen, really, it is the role of pastors. It's the role of communities. It's the role of your leaders in your communities to set examples. You know, you think about some of the worst social ills we have. If you have children before you're married, the chance of you being poor is like 95%. We can't make a law against that. You just can't make a law against that. And people do make mistakes, so I'm not condemning people who've made these mistakes. But still, someone's got to try to preach another alternative or talk about other alternatives before people have made those mistakes. But it's not really going to come from government. That's got to come from your community, from your church, from your elders. Right now, though, that's not the norm. Speaking of our values, I think, is sadly considered nonconformity. I think if your child likely has a better chance of being bullied at school if they're a Christian than if they're a cross-dresser. That's a sad state of affairs. And I mean it, because we've got all this stuff about, oh, you're going to bully somebody who's confused as gender dysphoria. No, I think they're going to bully the Christian who might speak up and say something. So this is where the idea of conformity and the idea of having the courage to nonconform is important. Pope Benedict XVI put it this way. He said, "It is true that a Christian faith taken seriously means nonconformity with contemporary social standards. The obligation of moral tradition, Christian or otherwise, is to recover the capacity for nonconformity rather than seeking either elite or mass approval." In other words, we must do something about our world that often the world is telling us not to do, that may not be popular. Seek God. For our redemption, our salvation, our country's revival depends on rediscovering the synthesis of freedom and tradition. Don Devine, the author, put it well when he said, "There must be a tolerance and even love for all other individuals, traditions and religions, since traditional values cannot be rightly imposed on other individuals. But it doesn't mean that we abandon or forsake our traditions and values, nor do we stop preaching or talking about them. Some seem to believe that you should choose liberty or virtue, that, you know, you can't be virtuous if you have too much liberty. This is exactly wrong. Liberty is absolutely essential to virtue. It is our freedom to make individual choices that makes us human and allows us to choose to be virtuous or not. Government can't impose virtue. We must impose it upon ourselves. This does not mean, though, that our government should or cannot reflect our values. It must. Should you elect good people? Should you elect people that represent your values? Absolutely. Government should never force us to abandon our faith to stay in business.
That's right.
Or abandon our business to be true to our faith. Reagan understood this unity of message when he wrote, "Freedom requires faith. It should never be decoupled from faith." Another way we as Christians should stand up to the current status quo is foreign policy. Reagan, in his first speech to the UN, said, "The record of history is clear. Citizens of the U.S. resort to force reluctantly and only when they must." Eisenhower expressed it similarly. Our foreign policy is not difficult to state. We are for peace, first, last, and always. Reagan believed in strength, but also peace. This is a quote from Reagan. "As for the enemies of freedom, they will be reminded that peace is the highest aspiration of the American people. We will negotiate for it, sacrifice for it, but we will not surrender for it now or ever." Our forbearance should never be misunderstood. Our reluctance for conflict should not be misjudged as failure of will. When action is required to preserve our national security, we will act. Reagan spoke often of peace through strength, but I fear our nation and some in our party have forgotten the first part of that sentence, that peace should be our goal even as we build our strength.
That's right.
Some in our party have distorted the belief in peace through strength to a misguided belief that we project strength through war. I know a lot of soldiers. I know there are soldiers here, some active, some retired. I know a freshly minted second lieutenant who's a son of one of my best friends who will be on the front lines. And I know he cares about his country and cares about war, but I know his parents also don't want him to go to a war that we haven't voted on, that we don't agree as a people is necessary. And we should not willy-nilly be having soldiers in Mali and Niger and all these misbegotten places with no vote, no discussion, and no mission. Niger, we have 1,500 troops in Niger. We had 4 troops die in Mali about 3 or 4 years ago, and one of the senators said he didn't even know they was on the armed services. He didn't even know they were there. Nobody knows what the mission is in these countries. In Niger, the leader of Niger came, and we're training him for democracy. He came back to the United States. We pay him. We have these training. They come to our military camps. We trained him in democracy, went home and executed a coup, and then kicked our soldiers out. We spent $100 million on a drone base there. We've got no business really doing that, no clear mission, and we ought to at the very least vote on it. You elect me, you can unelect me, but people in the Pentagon aren't elected. That's why we have civilian control of the military, and we should be voting on these things. Even sometimes when we've tried through good intentions to make the world a better place, things sometimes backfire. The Iraq War. I love our soldiers for fighting and doing everything they could. We had some people here who had tours in Iraq. But I think in the end, Iran is stronger because Saddam Hussein's gone. There was a counterbalance, and neither one of them are any good. The Khomeini and the Ayatollahs are evil, so was Saddam Hussein. But there was sort of a balance of evil. Now we've upended the balance, and now I think Iran is stronger than it's ever been. And some of that's because I think the mistake of getting involved in the Iraq War. Our religion also reminds us and makes statements about war. Jesus reminds us that our goal should be what he proclaims. "Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called the children of God." This doesn't mean we won't engage in war to defend ourselves. Doesn't mean we won't fight. It means that we're not eager for war. We commit to war reluctantly. We seek victory expeditiously. It's important to know that we approach war with our eyes open and understand that the consequences, all of the consequences, are not always seen. As Christians, we know we must always stand with the most defenseless. I believe that no civilization can long endure that does not respect life from those not yet born to life's last breath. Now that the Supreme Court has sent the issue of abortion back to the states, each state will decide legally when the government will protect life. In the heat of the debate, Christians should try to remember what should unite us all, that we are created in the image of God, that all human life is special, deserves respect and protection. Any disagreements on when and how life is legally going to be defined and protected should not obscure the Christian belief that all human life is sacred. As Christians, we understand that our rights are not granted by man. They come from God. They pre-exist government. Our rights are something that are innately and inherently ours. Nobody gives them to us, and no one should take them away from us. God help us in these troubling times to make these decisions, to make moral decisions, and to listen to the voice of God that lives and breathes and resides in us all. The paper, the painter, Robert Henry, wrote, "Don't paint the material, push on to paint the spirit." I love Henry's optimism. He also exhorted to young painters. He said, "Paint like a man coming over the hill singing." And I just love the image of that. I don't know how you paint while marching over a hill singing, but it sounds optimistic. Reagan also advised, he says, "Don't paint in pastels, paint in bold colors." Several years ago, I stood in the Garden of Gethsemane. As we stood there, awed at where we were, we sang, "How great thou art, how great thou art." It moved me, and is a moment in my life I will never forget. The hymn exhorts, "Then sings my soul, my Savior God, to thee." Today I ask you to sing out from your very soul. When our message bursts forth like song, when our message bursts forth with the passion of Patrick Henry, when our message comes as a song from our soul, full of compassion, full of enduring truth, then and only then will freedom reign. I'd like to close with a blessing my great-great-grandmother wrote to her son in 1903 when he was working a few hours away from their home in Youngstown, Ohio. She wrote to him, Our Sabbath was lovely, which I spent at home as usual, but the dear Lord willing, I hope I can go to his house again. Anyway, his grace is sufficient for me. There is a song in my soul today, a blessed sunshine that no outward circumstances can take away. The Lord is a sun and a shield to all those that trust in him. May he always be your guide. Amen.